From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John Gregory Dunn has reported on fact and has written fiction. With his wife, Joan Didion, he's written screenplays. On this edition of Fresh Air, Dunn tells how a life-threatening illness tricked him into finally writing about himself. Also today, we talk with cinematographer Stephen Burum. His first big assignment was in the film Apocalypse Now. The experience proved invaluable on his latest movie, Brian De Palma's Vietnam film Casualties of War. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Dream Season. It's a new sports show that shows what might have happened if the greatest football teams of all time got together to play each other. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. ambassador to Lebanon and his at least 29 American staff members were forced out of Lebanon today by Christians who claim the United States supports Syria. It is the first time an American ambassador has been pulled from Lebanon since the sectarian civil war began 14 years ago, and the move at least temporarily ends the American diplomatic presence in the country. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler angrily blamed the Christian Army commander Michel Aoun for the move. President Bush responded to criticisms of his anti-drug plan today, calling on Democrats to stop what he called partisan squabbling and get behind the proposed drug strategy. Drug Policy Director William Bennett issued his own defense in an appearance at the National Press Club. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
Bennett said the president's commitment to a new national strategy offers moral clarity to the question of drug abuse. Bennett seemed to dismiss many of the critics of the plan, referring to cynics and wet blankets. These are people, he said, who live by opposition. The most frequent criticism is that the Bush plan does not seek enough money to meet the crisis at hand. Bennett rejected that criticism, pointing to discussions in Congress over how much it planned to spend in the war on drugs.
I don't think it is fair, and I mean the word fair, for people in the Congress whose current House mark for drugs is $6 billion. That's what they are recommending, to criticize the president for proposing $8 billion.
Bennett did say this first strategy is not a request for all time, that he will ask for more money in future years. Tomorrow, Bennett goes to Capitol Hill to confront his congressional critics. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
Testimony resumed today in the trial of fallen television evangelist Jim Baker. Baker was declared competent to continue his trial following lengthy testimony from a psychiatrist. Ellie Boudreau reports from member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina.
A psychiatrist from the Butner Psychiatric Hospital testified today that Baker has a conventional personality with no underlying disorders that would keep him from assisting in his defense. Dr. Sally Johnson, one of the team of doctors who did Baker's psychological workup, said that the former televangelist suffered a series of panic attacks, probably brought on by stress. Baker was ordered to Butner, a facility that routinely evaluates federal defendants and prisoners, last week when he told of seeing menacing animal forms among the onlookers outside the courthouse. Also today, Judge Robert Potter denied a defense motion to delay the trial until Monday. This afternoon, he's expected to rule on a motion to declare a mistrial. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellie Boudreau in Charlotte, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 24 points to close at 2719.79. Advances led declines 5-2 on volume of 162 million shares. This is NPR News. The chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee today called on Congress to redirect U.S. foreign aid to protect the world environment. Democrat Patrick Leahy told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that he will introduce a bill aimed at helping countries develop economic alternatives that will save forests and other natural resources. According to a statement by Leahy's office, the bill would be aimed at providing more aid to third world countries, where development often means the destruction of tropical rainforests. More than 40 people who survived an air crash in the Amazon forest are today being brought to safety by Brazilian rescue teams after spending almost 3 days in the rainforest. The Brazilian Air Force is now reporting the death toll may rise as high as 13. Richard House has more from Sao Paulo.
The first contact with the Boeing airliner that vanished on Sunday night was a call to an amateur radio operator in southern Brazil. attempts to find help, a group of four male survivors struggled for hours through the dense forest to reach a farm close to where the pilot had made an emergency landing. Though the plane was located last night, the rescue operation was carried out today. After spending almost 3 days without food or water, the survivors had to walk through the forest to an airstrip, from whence they were ferried to hospitals in the capital, Brasilia. There's speculation the pilot may have lost his way due to a navigation error, but he showed great skill and courage in bringing the plane down onto densely wooded hills in total darkness after he had run out of fuel. For National Public Radio, this is Richard House in Sao Paulo.
A former savings and loan executive has been found guilty of using more than $55,000 in thrift funds to contribute to political campaigns and hire women from topless bars to accompany S&L officials on trips. Former Vernon Savings and Loan president Patrick King was convicted on charges including conspiracy and fraud. He could receive 65 years in prison. Sentencing is set for November 2nd. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. In 1987, writer John Gregory Dunn's doctor told him that he was a prime candidate for a heart attack. During a checkup, the doctor had found a critical lesion on a main artery. This scare set Dunn off reflecting on his life, and many of those reflections wound up in his new memoir, Harp. Harp is a derogatory term for an Irish Catholic. Dunn says he chose it because it's short, sharp, and abusive. Dunn is himself Irish Catholic, but he's a writer who's never afraid to be unpleasant. Dunn is a former staff writer for Time magazine. In 1969, he began writing fiction and realized the wealth of material available to him in his own Irish-American background. His novels include Vegas, True Confessions, Dutch Shay Jr., and The Red, White, and Blue. Since the mid-60s, he's been married to the writer Joan Didion. They've collaborated on screenplays for the films Panic in Needle Park, Play It As It Lays, the remake of A Star Is Born, and an adaptation of Dunn's novel True Confessions, which starred Robert De Niro and Robert Duvall. After the diagnosis of his heart condition, John Gregory Dunn had an angioplasty and has avoided open-heart surgery. I asked him what surprised him the most about his reaction to having a life-threatening condition.
I had never really been introspective before, and I think that if a doctor tells you that you're a candidate for a catastrophic event, it tends to focus your mind wonderfully. And you wonder who I am and how I got here. And so it was as a result of that that I began sort of thinking not about my life so much, but about the writer's life. This book was never meant to be a book. It was meant to be the introduction to a book of essays. And I was going to have an introduction of approximately 6,000 words, which is about 25 pages. And I began writing it, and it just got longer. And when I reached approximately 100 pages of manuscript, my wife said, "No, this is a book." I said, no, I can't even think of it that way. Otherwise, I'll just freeze up and not do it." And but by the time I got to be 150, 175 pages, even I knew that it was a book. But if I had thought of it as a book, the structure wouldn't have been as free form as it is in the book as it now stands, and I don't think I could have written it.
When you were having the heart problems and seeing doctors, did you try to impress your doctors that you were something special and they'd better really do a good job with you?
I mean, you do this, you do this thing. It came about accidentally. I was having an annual physical. I had an EKG, and the doctor, I was still buckled up with all the leads were still clamped to my chest, and the doctor said, "You have a glitch." And before he even took the clamps off, he called a cardiologist and had a meeting with me and set up an appointment for me that afternoon. And so I went, and I think you try to explain to the doctor, "Listen, I'm something special. You better bring all your talent to bear on me. I mean, I don't want to check out. I've got a lot of things I have to do." I think everyone feels that way, that he is special. He or she is special.
I thought it was funny the way you really found confidence in bragging about your doctors to other people, even in talking about, like, the great Jim Dine prints
that they
had on the
that's
wall.
That's right. The doctors were specialists in this procedure called balloon angioplasty, and I had done so many that they were asked to lecture all over the world, and I thought, well, you know, these guys are really good. And on the walls, they actually had very good prints on the walls, and they had Jim Dine prints, and I heard myself saying to a nurse one day, I actually know Jim and Nancy, and she looked at me as if I were bonkers. And then you sort of see, the thought occurs to you that you might die, and you sort of see omens every place. I remember one day I was putting Susan Sontag's telephone number in my, I have a computer telephone book, and I was putting her number in it, and I lost the entire telephone book. Through some sort of computer error. Well, Susan had written the book Illness and Metaphor. I thought that means that I'm going to die. That is the metaphor. The next day, through some fluke, I was able to refine her telephone number. And so I said, now I'm going to live. But you have the sense of, this is the last time I will go to Dodger Stadium. This is the last time I will go to this restaurant. This is the last time I'll buy a suit. Should I even buy a suit? I wouldn't even answer letters because I was afraid that if I did die, it would be too creepy for someone to receive a letter that that I had sent before I did die.
When you were experiencing all this, would you go through a reaction and then measure your response and say, is this response worthy of something I'd write in fiction, or is this a cliched response unworthy of the person who I am?
What I always knew was that this was really good material. And a writer is always sort of trolling for material. And so the first thing I did was open up a file which was called CAD, coronary artery disease, also CAD, which I thought sometimes people think I am. So it was, I knew that everything, including the Jim Dine prints and the doctor's walls and the sort of nurse ratchet when I checked into the hospital, that all this stuff was really good material. I think all writers are so detached that they see everything as a possible source of material.
My guest is John Gregory Dunn, and his new book is a series of autobiographical pieces. It's called Harp. You write about your encounter with possible death through heart problems. You write about the actual deaths of people in your family, the suicide of your brother, and the murder of your niece, Dominique Dunn, who is the daughter of your brother, the writer Dominic Dunn. And you explain you didn't go to the murder trial, and you even tried to convince your brother Dominic not to go, and that you'd like to think that if it had been your daughter who was murdered, that you wouldn't have gone to the trial. Why were you so opposed to attending the murder trial?
Well, I'd been to so many murder trials, and essentially, I'd been to so many murder trials which I'd covered as a reporter or just gone out of writer's interest. And I knew that in any murder trial, the victim is always put on trial. And shortly before the trial began, I had dinner one night with an old friend of mine, David Halberstam, and David's brother had been murdered the year before. And he said to me, are you going to go to the trial? And I said, my instinct is not to. And he said, don't. He said, because, he said, the person they're going to talk about up there bears no relation to person who you know. And in most murder trials, the victim is made a co-conspirator in her own murder, and it was just awful thinking of that. Then there was an additional thing, which I did not put in the book. My wife and I were both on the witness list, as was my daughter, and we had reason to suspect, good reason, that we would be called as hostile witnesses by the defense, and we wanted no part of that, and so we left.
Your brother Dominic not only attended the trial but reported on it for Vanity Fair. What was your reaction to his reporting on it?
It was intensely moving. My feeling about that is I don't wish to impose my view on anyone else. I just don't want to I don't want to be a part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find it cathartic.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you, since you've written about the death of people in your family and your own fear of death when you found out about, you know, the heart problems you were having, I was wondering if you now think of yourself as being more obsessively absorbed when that kind of period comes over you about your own death or about the possible death of people close to you? Do you know what I mean? I think everybody goes through these periods of, like, really getting involved with thinking about death.
I think one of the oddest things about this whole experience is that I used to be terrified of my own death.
Uh-huh.
I am less so now. I am terrified about the death of loved ones, but not really about my own.
Why are you less worried about your own death now?
I think because once you brush mortality or have a brush with mortality, that you not bad, but it's no longer unknown, and I think it's the unknown that is terrifying.
Do you ever get very irrational in your fears of the death of others?
Not irrational. I just sometimes. I mean, if I hear the telephone ring at 3 o'clock in the morning, I hate to pick it up because there's nothing good that can come from a telephone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's either going to be a drunk or a hang up or a wrong number or something like that, or it's going to be bad news. That's how I got the news of my brother's suicide. And that's how I got the news of my niece's murder. And so, if I hear the telephone ring at 4 o'clock in the morning now, I just cannot make myself pick up the phone.
But you will pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break, then we'll talk some more. My
sure.
guest is writer John Gregory Dunn. He's written journalism, novels, screenplays. His new book, Harp, is a memoir, and it's just been published. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer John Gregory Dunn is my guest. In your new book, Harp, you write that your motto is get mad and get even. And you say, although it is not necessary for a writer to be an expletive, neither does it hurt. Resentment sharpens his eye. Hostility hones his killer instinct. Is this a persona or is this a philosophy for you about writing?
I think essentially it is a philosophy. I think most writers are outsiders. Writing itself is an astonishingly hostile and aggressive act. I mean, you can cover up the writing with subordinate clauses and make it flowery, et cetera, and so forth. But what you are saying to the reader is, this is how I view things. I want you to view things my way. And no matter how nice you make the writing, you are still imposing yourself and your view of things on the reader. So it starts off being a very hostile and aggressive act. Then I think that writers are essentially outsiders, that they find their material where it, everything they see is a source of material, and their nose is always pressed up against the window on the other side of which usually is their material. And I think it is that being an outsider that makes it hostile, or that makes you hostile.
You talk about writing being a hostile and aggressive act, and I'm reminded of the fact that you say when you go to someone's house, you always examine their medicine chest and see what kind of pills they're taking to find out what's up with them.
Well, I think that you can find... I mean, this is when I do visit... Now, obviously, I have blown my cover,
dinner invitations, right?
and so, but you can find entire social and sexual and personal histories in someone's and needless to say medical histories in mm-hmm. in someone's medicine chest, and I always used to look in the medicine chest, and it's amazing that since I wrote that, the number of people who have come up to me and whispered that they do too.
Well, how much of a license to be a snoop does writing give you, do you think?
I think it gives you total license, but I think that if you get caught, you have to pay the penalty.
My guest is writer John Gregory Dunn. He has a new book. It's a series of autobiographical pieces called Harp. One of the things that you did after you got over your heart problems was to go to Ireland, and you're of Irish Catholic descent,
mm-hmm.
and describe your family as having gone from steerage to suburbia in three generations.
Mm-hmm.
But that, on the other hand, you never really related much to being Irish Catholic till you were in your 40s.
That's not quite true. I never related to being Irish, Irish from Ireland. My Irishness was a component of parochial school and of priests and nuns, but not of the place called Ireland. And I never really had any interest in going to the place called Ireland. And then after this medical experience, I decided to go to Ireland to see if I could track down my grandfather's birth records. He had come from Ireland in the late 1860s as a young boy, and so I was sort of interested in finding out where he came from, and indeed if I had any Irish relatives in Ireland. And so I went there in a kind of quest, Holy Grail, and just ran up against a brick wall, and I found nothing in the town where he was said to have been born. There, I had checked all the baptismal records, because there were no civil records kept in Ireland until in the late 1860s, and he'd been born in 1857. And so so I checked all the baptismal records, and I ran up against a brick wall.
Did going to Ireland give you a sense of a deeper connection to the country than you'd felt before? Did
No.
you still feel disconnected from it?
Yes. Enduring feeling I had from it was how beautiful it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was there in early June. There was no rain. It was very sunny. I went to the west coast of Ireland, and I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful place. Maybe in northern New Mexico. I mean, it was absolutely gorgeous.
But that's different from feeling connection
no,
to the country.
Uh-uh.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't want to force that feeling.
That's right.
Yeah, I've read about you that you stuttered as a child.
Still do.
Oh, well, you're certainly not right now. But I was wondering how, I was going to ask you how you got over it. Maybe you think you didn't, although, you know, you really sound
quite
good.
Well, you get over it because you set up a kind of distant early warning system. You know that there are certain letters and certain words that you would stumble over. And so you prepare detours around the minefields of speech. I've always thought that I don't like to listen to a tape of myself because I notice a very odd herky-jerky cadence in the way I talk. And the reason for that is I anticipate that I'm going to stammer over something. And so find a synonym and, you know, do something to, as I said, to detour around the minefields of speech.
Mm-hmm. So you still feel a little self-conscious about speaking
Absolutely.
Publicly?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you a little bit about being a two-writer family. Your wife is the writer, Joan Didion. And I don't know if you read or edit each other's work, but I wonder if you feel that to really know each other fully, that you have to read everything that the other person wrote.
I don't know if you have to know someone if you have to read what he or she wrote. We just do, and we always have. Joan and I were friends for 6 or 7 or 8 years before we began keeping company, and so this is a long-standing process with us. The only thing we do together is a motion picture screenplay. But when we are working on a prose piece, we do show each other the things that we are working on. And because we are so close to each other, we give each other very much more acute advice, I think, than a normal editor would give, because we know how the other thinks, and we think we know where the work is going. And so we can say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And I am forever grateful for the advice that she has given me, and I think that she would say the same about me.
I don't know how you are in accepting criticism or how she is, but it's sometimes not easy to accept criticism, no matter how accurate you realize it is. Does that kind of editing process and the criticism ever get in the way of...
Not really, no. I mean, I used to be... Joan would never sort of say anything directly to me, but I knew that if she didn't meet my eye, that she didn't like what she had read when she talked to me. When I was younger, I used to say something was junk, or that she missed the point, which I wouldn't say now, but now I wouldn't have to. I would say, I don't think this is working, and why don't you do X, Y, or Z? And that's never really been a problem.
You've collaborated together on screenplays. Are you writing any more screenplays?
Just finished one.
Of what?
It's an original or quasi-original screenplay for Disney, and it's about a young woman who gets out of college and goes to work in TV, and it's about the years when she's in local TV stations, and it ends with her getting the call to the network.
Do you know who's going to be in it?
Oh, no, we just finished. Mm-hmm. Just finished yesterday.
You once made the observation that you can never tell from a screenplay if a movie's going to be any good, because some of the best screenplays have been developed into some of the worst movies, and, uh-huh. and vice versa. Do you find that very frustrating when you write a screenplay?
No, it's one of the givens of making movies. I've said many times that that the best a screenwriter can hope to be in the process is a co-pilot. Those are just... decisions over which you have no control.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you'll be writing a memoir again?
Never.
Why not?
I've done it, and the next time I won't be able to fool myself that I'm not doing it. The only reason I was able to continue on this one was that I was still thought of it as an introduction. I don't think I would ever do anything formal again.
Are there... Is there fallout from writing a memoir that you don't like?
No.
Uh-huh. Okay.
No. I just don't think that my life has been all that interesting, and it's just what you make of it.
Right. So how's your health now?
Terrific.
What's the prognosis with your heart?
Good. Everything's fine. I've had a series of tests. Everything's fine.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your writing. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Gregory Dunn has been my guest, and his new memoir, Harp, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Charles Grodin. He most recently starred with Robert De Niro in Midnight Run. His long career in show business includes stints as a member of the Actors Studio and starring roles on Broadway. He was a writer for Candid Camera and a screenwriter and producer for movies and TV. He's written a new autobiography called It Would Be So Nice If You Weren't Here. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the new Brian De Palma film, Casualties of War, cinematographer Stephen Burem captures the anguish on the face of Michael J. Fox. But what you don't see is the strain Burem was under. Coming up, Stephen Burem talks about filming in the jungle of Thailand. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of Strauss family waltzes performed by the Vienna Philharmonic. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Dream Season, a new cable sports show that highlights the greatest football games never played. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Reaction heard in Colombia to President Bush's war against drugs appears to have been positive for the most part. However, there's one part of the president's plan that has not gone down as well. Alan Tomlinson reports from Bogota.
At issue in the case is who will pay for the care of nearly 4,000 mentally retarded adults in Philadelphia who live at home. Due to cuts in the allocation from the state, city officials have discontinued many counseling, workshop, and daycare programs. Among those testifying today was Leona Fielkowski. Until July, her severely retarded son David attended a program where he received physical therapy and was being taught how to take care of himself.
Our children are going to regress. They are going to lose what skills they have learned in the past 20-some years from schooling and from the programs they've been in.
Attorneys representing the retarded argue that Pennsylvania law requires the state to provide funds for such programs. A decision in the case, the first of its kind in the country, is not expected for several weeks. For National Public Radio, this is Greg Allen in Philadelphia.
That story concerned a story today in Philadelphia where attorneys for the city and the families of retarded adults went to court to try to force the state of Pennsylvania to pay for daycare and vocational programs for the mentally retarded. And now Alan Tomlinson reporting from Bogota.
There's been no official Colombian response to President Bush's address, but U.S. officials here say they've been hearing generally favorable reaction from the government. Outside official circles, what has not been so well received here is the president's pledge to pursue the death penalty for the drug kingpins. There's no death penalty in Colombia, and juridically no Colombian can be extradited to the United States to face harsher punishment than he would get at home. What's more, say some Colombians, the death penalty remark could heighten the violence of the drug bosses who may rather die fighting than go to the electric chair. The violence here continues. Two members of an American TV crew were among those hurt when a bomb went off at a fashionable restaurant in Medellin. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Bogota.
In Charlotte, North Carolina, the judge in the fraud trial of PTL founder Jim Baker has denied a motion for a mistrial by attorneys for Baker. Earlier, Judge Robert Potter ruled that Baker is competent to stand trial after a government psychiatrist testified that Baker was not mentally ill when he broke down last week, but rather suffered a panic attack. In early returns from South African elections, leftist and far-right opposition parties have gained in power. It appears that the governing National Party is headed for its worst setback in 41 years in power. Police with whips, tear gas, and shotguns dispersed blacks protesting their exclusion from today's voting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 25 points to close at 2,719.80. There was only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new album recorded in Vienna last New Year's Eve. But Lloyd says it might be just as suitable for dancing under the stars at summer's end. It's music by members of the Strauss family, and the conductor is the elusive Carlos Kleiber, the son of one of the great Viennese conductors of the century.
No one can trace the history of the waltz with absolute certainty. The word waltz itself comes from the Latin volvere, to turn. Couples who were willing to risk a public display of intimacy between the sexes were circling the dance floors before the end of the 18th century. In 1819, Carl Maria von Weber's Invitation to the Dance for piano was probably the model for all subsequent concert waltzes. But of course, it's the Strauss family that we associate most with the Viennese waltz. Papa Johann was a violist and conductor. He was a largely self-taught musician, trained as a bookbinder. He died at 45. His older son, also Johann, became the waltz king. His more melancholy younger son, Josef, died at 43. The Strausses didn't invent the Viennese waltz, but they developed it into the elegant, complex, and richly colorful form we know. Strauss waltzes are no less than symphonic tone poems. They can evoke a poetic setting, like the Vienna woods or the beautiful Blue Danube, or an entire social order. What more vivid symbol of the Habsburg monarchy than the Emperor waltz? It's a far cry from the beer gardens where Viennese waltzes first caught on. If you've ever heard any of the old recordings by the great Viennese conductors, Bruno Walter, Felix Weingartner, Erich Kleiber, you know what buoyant and magical, even profound experiences the best waltzes can be. Not at all the stainless steel oom-pah-pahs of today's pops concerts. This new Strauss album, which was recorded live at the Vienna Philharmonic's 1989 New Year's concert, gives me some hope for the future of Viennese light music. The conductor is Carlos Kleiber, Erich Kleiber's son. A wonderful musician who doesn't seem to like recording studios or crossing the Atlantic. He made his Metropolitan Opera debut only in 1988. One of his few recordings is his much-admired version of Johann Strauss's most famous operetta, Die Fledermaus. The overture to that is one of the delights of this new recording, as is a selection that includes not only famous waltzes, but such rarities as Joseph Strauss's The Chatterbox, The Jockey, and this one, the Dragonfly Polka. Carlos Kleiber has many of his father's gifts. These performances balance discipline and flexibility. They have that teasing lift on the second beat, that instant of weightlessness most modern orchestras can't seem to get right. Individual moments keep their special delicacy, yet each piece seems built on a large and expansive scale. On some of those old recordings from half a century ago, though, I also hear a quality of tenderness in the playing, a knowing affection for the style that gives the upswings a little more zip, that makes the nostalgia a shade more mysterious and sad. Those old records remind us that some things may be lost forever. Carlos Kleiber, in his moving performance of Artist's Life, proves he's learned that from his father, too.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new CBS Masterworks recording of Carlos Kleiber conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Burem was the director of photography on the new film Casualties of War, directed by Brian De Palma. Burem also worked with De Palma as the cinematographer on The Untouchables and Body Double. Casualties of War is based on a true story. In 1966, five American soldiers on a reconnaissance mission in Vietnam took a detour to kidnap a Vietnamese girl. She was raped by four of the men, then killed. In the film, Sean Penn plays the sergeant who plans the crime. Michael J. Fox plays the private who refuses to participate in the gang rape and tries to stop the murder. For Casualties of War, Brian De Palma used a Mac computer to draw all of the major shots he wanted to use in the picture. Film critic Pauline Kael wrote that although De Palma has mapped out his shots, the film is alive and mysterious. I asked Burem what he was presented with before he began shooting.
It's not a carefully drawn storyboard like you would imagine for an animated picture where you have the characters. What it is, it's more representational stuff. It circles with faces and where the people are in relationship to each other in the frame. It's more like a hieroglyphic kind of a plan.
Do you like working that way where most of the major shots are already designed, or do you prefer to have more room when you're shooting a film?
Well, the major shots aren't really designed. They're not really designed that much. They're designed as far as emotional content and story point are, but as far as the choice of lenses, the composition, how we move the camera, how the light is used, isn't really decided upon until we see the scene.
Mm-hmm. The action within the frame is very carefully composed. There's a scene in which the Vietnamese woman who is kidnapped and raped is stabbed. But actually, most of the frame is taken up by Michael J. Fox's face.
Mm-hmm.
And he's concentrating on the fighting around him. Mm-hmm. and on his gun.
Mm-hmm.
And over his shoulder in the background, kind of in the corner of the screen,
mm-hmm.
one of the soldiers is stabbing this woman several times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Michael J. Fox misses it. And if the viewer isn't careful, they're going to miss it too, because the camera has kind of diverted your attention a little bit. Can you talk about composing that? I think
it's
very effective.
Brian didn't want to point up the killing that much. He wanted you to know it was happening, but he didn't want to dwell on it. So what you do is you just split the composition like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because you put her on the left side of the frame, because of your natural eye scan, you start on that side of the frame. It's like when people read a book, they always start, on the upper left, and they scan across to the right and then back.
Is that true? Do people read images that way?
Yeah. People who are educated to read that way do. In China, where you would read a different way, you'd have a different kind of eye scan.
Gee, I wonder if I'm kind of visually illiterate in that respect, because I think I sometimes look at the biggest thing first, the biggest thing that's moving.
Well, that's one of the elements, too. When you do a motion picture, when you compose for a motion picture, you have a lot of things that you have to think about. One of them is what's moving. Of course, what moves gets attention. Bigness gets attention. Position in the frame gets attention. You just balance all those different things off.
Michael J. Fox is the moral conscience of Casualties of War, and there are many close-ups on his face as his face registers the action going on around him and registers what he's internally thinking, how he's responding to the decisions he's going to have to make. Tell me a little bit about what you thought about in shooting those close-ups on his face so that you'd get internal thought registering on the face, and also so that you'd shoot him in such a way so that people wouldn't think family ties.
Well, that was kind of a little bit of a problem, because what we tried to do was to make him look a little more stressed as the show went on. And he's one of those people who just has a wonderful young face that doesn't look stressed. So what we tried to do was to move the light around so he looks like he has dark circles. And we also did that with makeup and things like that. But it's mostly his acting. It's what you see in his eyes. I mean, movie acting is basically seeing into the actor's eyes and having them think what they're thinking, and the audience reads that.
Mm-hmm. Casualties of War was shot in Thailand, in the jungle. Do you have to learn about jungle light before you can effectively shoot there?
Oh, sure. I was there a month ahead of time, and I shot photographic tests and everything else. The light in the jungle is diabolical. It changes so much that it's very difficult to keep a sequence even. In fact, in the picture, there are several shots that Brian left in where you actually see the sun go in and out in the shot.
And what's difficult about that for you?
Well, what's difficult is that when you photograph a motion picture, you photograph it in chunks. You do a long shot here, you do a close-up there, and you may have as many as 20 pieces in a minute and a half's worth of action. Well, the light doesn't go in and out 20 times. You want to keep it consistent so people don't see that changing, because it may take you a full day to do that.
Were there heat and humidity problems you ran into with the equipment that you need?
Oh, yeah. It was the equipment we had, especially the electronic equipment, didn't like the heat at all and didn't like the humidity. We had a lot of breakdowns in the electronic motor boards and the cameras and in the electronic viewfinding system. It's kind of like a little TV camera. We had a lot of those break down.
Mm-hmm.
But we have backups for all that kind of stuff. The other thing that was happening is that fungus would grow in the lenses.
Oh, God.
So we had two sets of lenses, and when one, you'd get this kind of misty, webby stuff in them, and then you'd take them, you'd have the assistants take them in, and we'd put them in the freezer overnight, and that would kill the fungus. But after a while, you'd get a lot of white powder in the lenses, and you'd have to send them back to the States and have them cleaned out.
De Palma said that this was the movie in which there were the most accidents of any movie he's ever worked on. Did you have any close calls yourself?
Oh, yeah. I was up on a big parallel that we had a dolly track on, and we were rehearsing the shot. I was laying it out, and the wheel came off, and the whole dolly and the camera came off and threw me off, and luckily, I had a very good dolly grip, Chunky Hughes, and he held it for just a split second, and I was able to roll out from underneath it, or else it would have done me in for sure. But I seriously hurt my foot, and I was, the rest of the picture, I was hobbling around on a crutch.
Do those close calls scare you?
Sure. You don't think much about them. It just happens.
There's some scenes toward the end of the movie of a fighting and of firebombing. Is that kind of war footage particularly hard to shoot because you're actually burning up land, and if you don't get it the first time around, you've already burned it up?
Oh, yeah, it is. But what we have is we have extra plants and we have extra everything. It takes a little bit of time to reset that kind of operation. It takes maybe 3 or 4 hours to reset that.
What's the process like of looking for the right place to plant your camera before doing a shot?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to know what the story is about and what the script says and what you have to do for the day. Then the next thing you have to do is you have to see the rehearsal, and the director shows you a rehearsal. Then you look for the best physical background for whatever the action is, and you have to determine also how long it's going to take you to do it, because the light changes. So you want yourself in a kind of a configuration so as the light changes, you can take advantage of it, and it's not a hindrance to you.
Mm-hmm. There's beautiful music in this movie by Ennio Morricone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's music that really communicates the sense of loss and regret throughout the film. Do you always know where the music's going to go as you're shooting? And are you ever surprised by how something you've shot looks after music is added?
I'm not surprised by it. It's kind of a funny thing. When you work on a picture and it's silent, after you've seen it so many times, you don't really like it. You kind of think it doesn't work. And then when the music's added to it, suddenly it gives it a new life. I'm never particularly surprised about the music because I expect it to be there.
You worked on Apocalypse Now,
mm-hmm.
and on Casualties of War, and it seems to me that Brian De Palma, the director of Casualties of War, is just the opposite of Francis Ford Coppola, the director of Apocalypse Now. From everything I've read, Apocalypse Now is a movie that was basically made in the editing room. You know, story-wise, it was really pieced together there. Whereas De Palma goes in with everything very well composed beforehand. Do you have any preference for technique as a cinematographer?
No, I've photographed two pictures for Francis, Rumblefish and Outsiders, and I photographed the second unit on Apocalypse for him. And Francis just has a different way of working. He kind of turns everybody loose, and Brian's a little more planned, like you said. But it's the difference between two people telling a joke. You have two storytellers. If you have Jack Benny and you have, Don Rickles, you're gonna have the same joke and you're gonna get a laugh. But you have two different ways of telling it, and that's all it is. To me, it's fun doing it either way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about Casualties of War. Thank you.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, Terry.
Cinematographer Stephen Burem was the director of photography for the new film Casualties of War. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, how are you following the reaction to last night's address by the president on his new drug policy?
In a variety of ways, Terry. We're going to go to the Hill to see what members of Congress think about this program and how it will work. We expect to hear from the Andean nations, precisely from Colombia. We have some people who are critical of the treatment aspect of the president's program, and we're going to take a look at how other efforts to stop drugs on the street have worked, a study on the economics of marijuana. And we do have a few other things besides drugs on the show. We're going to take a look at children having children.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's been a lot of criticism lately about so-called recreations on TV when news shows simulate famous crimes and events. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new ESPN show that goes even further. Using two computers, it creates football games that never happened at all.
Take an impossible journey through the corridors of time as 20 of the mightiest champions in NFL history wage a battle for pro football supremacy. This is the dream season.
This is the kind of idea that might even excite people who don't normally watch football on TV. And for football fanatics, it's like a super-duper Super Bowl. Football's 20 best teams of all time playing a series of games that end up with one team being crowned the all-time champ. Here's the deal. NFL Films went to the Exor Corporation, which uses team statistics to generate a computer football game called NFL Challenge. With the Exor database, NFL Films set up a league and a schedule for football's 20 best teams, then ran each matchup through the computer 100 times. The average results from those 100 test runs became the games you'll see on Dream Season, and that's where the other computer, the one owned by NFL Films, comes in. Thanks to a complex cross-indexing system of zillions of hours of videotape, NFL Films was able to splice together highlights from each of these Dream Season games. The series kicked off on Sunday as two great teams from two different eras faced each other in the opening game.
Hello, everybody. I'm Merrill Reese. We have what should be a tremendous game. The 85 Bears won 18 of 19 games, while the 77 Cowboys were 15-2. Both were exceptional in all phases of the game.
Just like a regular NFL game, the Dream Season shows include interviews with coaches and players. We hear from Tom Landry, who coached the 77 Cowboys, and Mike Ditka, who's in the unusual position of playing against himself. He was head coach of the 85 Bears and was also an assistant coach with the 77 Cowboys.
It probably would have been a game that would have ended up somewhere around 24-21, maybe 28-24, something like that. It wouldn't matter to me who won it, but we'll give this one to Tom. We'll say the Cowboys would have beat us.
With a Roger Staubach and the type of receivers that we had at that time, we would have gone to the air against them.
So which team wins? Let's go to the videotape.
And so the dream season has turned into a nightmare for the Cowboys.
According to our computer, in this second quarter, the Bears have held the Cowboys to minus 2 yards total offense. Woo!
But thanks to a typical Cowboys comeback, the game is up for grabs on the very last play, as Staubach sails a Hail Mary pass towards the end zone.
Hampton charges. This is it. Staubach is back. One more time.
There it goes.
He's firing deep downfield.
Want to know what happens? That's the whole point. These games are lots of fun, even though they aren't real. The next dream game is played September 17th, when the series becomes a weekly feature on ESPN. And since the Bears-Cowboys game has already been shown, we may as well finish with the finish to that particular contest. By the way, my bet for the Dream Game Super Bowl teams, the 78 Steelers versus the 72 Dolphins. See you at the game.
It is knocked away! Mike Richardson bangs it away! The Bears hang on, they survive! No miracles for Staubach and the Cowboys today as the Bears win it 34-28. We'll be back with the wrap-up right after this.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our researchers are Chris Cook and Andrew Kaplan. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Charles Grodin reflects on his long and often rocky career in show business, and we meet Doug Somm, a Tex-Mex rocker who made it big posing as an Englishman during the 60s British invasion. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.